You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, September 12, 2007, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hi, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Lashana Tova, everyone.
The what?
Same to you, buddy.
Lashana Tova.
Gesundheit.
Have a good New Year. Happy New Year.
Oh, right.
Isn't it the Jewish New Year?
Yeah, thank you,
Steve. I believe it's Rosh Hashanah.
Rosh Hashanah. So,
that's right.
Happy New Year to all our Jewish friends out there. What?
Today is also the year 2000 in what country? I think Ethiopia. They had their calendar is different than the rest of the world's.
Jesus died 7 years later?
Well, Rebecca, welcome back from Alaska.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
How was your trip?
It was wonderful.
Tell us all about it. Tell us every single thing that you said.
Okay. Well, I started by leaving early in the morning on Saturday.
Okay, that's enough.
Oh, okay. It was great. I met so many awesome skeptics and just had a wonderful time. Alaska is beautiful, of course. And seeing it with Randy and Phil Plait and Richard Saunders, it was really awesome. It was just a great way to do it. Lots of crazy pseudoscience out there, which is interesting.
Out where? Out in the Arctic tundra?
There were a number of different varieties of pseudoscience. For instance, on the cruise itself, they were peddling acupuncture, which made everyone erupt into laughter every single time they announced it. Though, sadly, we didn't get a chance to storm the acupuncture lounge because we kept having our own lectures during that. That probably would have been cool, but also might have gotten us thrown off the ship. So that's probably for the best. And then on shore, there were some interesting things like their own specific native brand of alternative healing, a thing called Devil's Club ointment, which is basically just this greasy stuff that they expect you to rub on your body for pretty much anything. Arthritis was mentioned, psoriasis, radiation burns, because, you know.
They encountered that? Traditional healers encountered a lot of radiation?
Apparently. We didn't actually see the sun the whole time we were there, so I'm not really sure where the radiation burns are coming from. But
Rebecca, let me get this straight. They call it Devil's Rub, and it's supposed to cause or cure these things.
It's called Devil's Club, C-L-U-B.
Oh, Devil's Club.
And it's supposed to cure them. Although, the funny thing is that they have these disclaimers up. So they have one sheet of paper showing a list of all the things that this ointment cures. And then right next to that is a sign that says, this ointment does not cure any disease.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, well, okay. So I'll just ignore that first sheet of paper with the big letters on it.
That's, you have to do that. That's the FDA disclaimer they got to put
right. Although not all of them do it. So
no, only about half do what they're supposed
right.
to.
So there's that. And, but other than those things, I mean, it's just so much fun going with a huge group of skeptics, and we always have a blast. So it was basically just like the amazing meeting in Vegas that you guys were at, just like that with all the partying and the talking. I mean, everybody you talk to is pretty much has an interesting story to tell, and it's just like being among friends, even if it's people you've never met. So I know I made a lot of new skeptical friends, which was awesome. So,
oh, great.
Excellent.
Yeah.
That's always
so
good.
I highly recommend that people make it to the next Amazing Adventure cruise, which is going to the Galapagos next year.
Oh, I would totally do that.
Cool.
I would love to go do that.
Yeah. The only downside is that it's kind of expensive, and there are only a few spots left. So yeah. If people want to hang out with such a great group without spending all that money, the Amazing Meeting 5.5 is coming up in January. And then the Amazing Meeting 6, which is going to be in Vegas, is going to be in June, I think.
June.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's right.
And I also got some great audio for my next entry in the Public Radio Talent Quest, which this is a blatant plug. But next week, they will have voting available. And it is the last round of the Talent Quest at publicradioquest.com. And this is the big one. This is, there are five of us left, and three of us will get basically our own pilot show to pitch to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. So I really need everybody to log on and vote.
Absolutely. Well, good luck.
Thank
you. Got it.
But yeah, it's good to be back anyway.
Today is September 12th. Yesterday was the 6th anniversary of 9/11, the terrorist attack on the United States. Of course, 9/11 conspiracy theorists are still alive and well. So we have to do just one brief story on a 9/11 conspiracy theory just to mark the occasion. There was a recent study in the news. This was written by Dr. Keith Seffin, who is a Cambridge University engineer. And he set out just to ask a very specific question. Could the World Trade Center towers have fallen the way they did? Just, you know, from a mathematical analysis of the engineering structure, you know, of the structure from an engineering point of view. And he concluded that, well, yes, they could. In fact, the energies involved and the stresses on the supports, et cetera, would have resulted in the collapse as it occurred.
I'm shocked.
Shocked.
Well, we knew that all along.
Yeah, I mean, he's not the first one to conclude that, but it's good. It's more confirmation of the standard model of how the towers fell, and is more evidence against the conspiracy theorists who claim that the towers could not have fallen unless there was a deliberate demolition, for which there's no evidence. Seffin characterizes the progressive collapse theory of how the towers fell as a fair assumption in terms of how the building fell. He said, "One thing that confounded engineers is how falling parts of the structure plowed through undamaged building beneath and brought the towers down so quickly." And so that was the specific question that he addressed with his calculations. So more evidence to support the standard view of how the towers fell and against any conspiracy theories.
Unfortunately, it won't change the minds of the conspiracy theorists.
No. One sentence kind of struck me from that article that I read on this, and it said that, "But it was not clear why the undamaged building should have offered little resistance to these falling parts," and that's part of what was studied. That just struck me as odd, that it wasn't clear why there was such little resistance. To me, I mean, can you imagine the kinetic energy of the top, you know, how many floors? I mean, it collapsed starting with the area that was impacted.
Damaged,
that was like
right.
Floor in the 90s or 100. So basically you've got a dozen floors or more coming down. It's not just one floor. It's the whole top of the building coming down on that first floor underneath, I guess, where the structure.
Yeah, 10% of the building.
I wonder if anybody's mind will be changed because of this particular study.
I doubt it.
The fence sitters maybe, but none of the hardcore guys.
Another news item. This was sent to us by a number of our listeners. This is a story about burning seawater as a possible energy source. Now, we covered this exact story a couple of months ago. This is about inventor John Canisius, who uses radio waves to separate or weaken the bonds between water molecules in salt water, and then burns the salt water to get energy out of it.
Or the bonds of the hydrogen and
the
oxygen.
Right. And he's claiming that this is a possible energy source. As we discussed before, that this, you know, the laws of thermodynamics say otherwise, that the radio waves, that the energy that he's putting into the system through the radio waves is greater than the energy that he's getting out of the back end by burning the hydrogen and oxygen. So this is not an energy source, it's just an energy conduit. But the only reason why I'm bringing it up again is because this story, for some reason, is now making the rounds anew. I think because it was picked up by the Associated Press, and then once the Associated Press picks it up, then every major news outlet just copies it from the Associated Press. This was on CBS News, was the one that was most commonly linked to us. So this is a major, mainstream news outlet. They picked the story from the AP, which doesn't have a hint of skepticism in it. Does not bring up the possibility that, or the criticism that this is not a source of energy because energy is being put into the system. The headline reads "possible energy source," which is absolutely untrue.
Right. So, and then they throw quotes around. They throw quotes around, like from this chemist, Rustam Roy, saying, seeing it burns gives me the chills. Mm-hmm. Or they'll have lines like, the discovery has scientists excited by the prospect of using salt water, the most abundant resource on Earth, as a fuel. I mean, come on. There should have been, you know, even the token skeptical sentence would have been nice.
Nothing. Yeah. So is this, we bring it up more just because it's making the rounds in the news again. You know, listen to the previous episode, which we'll link to in the notes page, where we discussed it in detail. And it's just another example of gullibility and lack of scientific skepticism on the part of the mainstream media. To an appalling degree, really. This is just
basic
fact checking to bring into a story like this. The last news item was sent to us by a couple of chaps who call themselves the Extant Dodos. Now, they are two MD-PhD students who have put together some videos for YouTube where they take clips from videos produced by the Creation Science Evangelism, or CSE, essentially, you know, knocking evolution and promoting creationism. And then they scientifically take apart the claims. But they're using clips from the videos produced by the CSE. The CSE now has, until very recently, they had statements, you know, on their websites and on their videos that would be essentially waiving their copyright and saying the videos can be used openly. In addition to that, taking clips from a video or taking, you know, like quotations from a written source falls under fair use. You know, if you are giving it attribution, if you're using it as an instructional tool, and you're not just copying it and selling it or copying it and duplicating it somewhere, if you're just using it as an educational tool, especially if you're doing exactly what they're doing, which is taking it piece by piece for commentary, that totally falls under fair use. So there's, for those two reasons, they overtly gave up their copyright, and in any case, it's being used fairly. But what the CSE are doing is that they're apparently scouring YouTube for any videos critical of them and their material, and then they are claiming that anyone that uses any clips of theirs in order to criticize them is violating their copyright. They're obviously not making the same claims about those who are spreading the clips in a favorable light. And then they're, you know, strong-arming YouTube into shutting them down or removing on YouTube. I don't know how much resources they expend looking into this. If somebody claims and says, this is violating my copyright, they tend to take it down first and ask questions later. So YouTube has taken down a lot of these videos. And then they're also threatening to sue the Extant Dodos for violation of their copyright. So they're just using intimidation strong-arm tactics to silence their critics. They don't have a leg to stand on, but even if they don't, they can still drag them through the courts, make them spend their time and resources to defend themselves, and even if you win in the end, it could still not be worth it.
And even expose them to the potential harm based on the threats they've been receiving.
Yeah, I mean, they claim, you know, they sent me an email personally describing their situation, and they say that they get a fair number of actual threats, not just insults, you know, but actual threats against them and their families from the followers of CSE. And they're afraid that these threats will ramp up, and it only takes, you know, one lunatic in the mix to do real harm. So they're, you know, they're understandably being cautious, and I think that, you know, a couple of students just trying to do the right thing, just trying to, you know, get their ideas out there and set the record, the scientific record straight, you know, basically to counteract some nonsense an activity that we're familiar with over here. And they're getting intimidated out of doing that. They're being silenced, you know, by CSE thugs. It's terrible.
It really is. But on the bright side, if I can quote the email, they state that our ultimate goal was to bring CSE, their practices and claims under scrutiny. And in the end, it seems that CSE has only managed to draw further scrutiny to the disparity between their claims and their actions. So they did achieve part, you know, pretty much what their objective was, which is good. And people have copied these videos off of YouTube, and now they're dispersing them elsewhere.
Yes.
And you could still find them. So, I mean, because, once it's on the internet, once it's on the web, that's it. It's there.
It's true. And historically, many of these attempts to silence critics has backfired, like when Scientology tried to get South Park to not, the Comedy Channel to not air the South Park episode that was very critical of Scientology, that actually just garnered more viewers for that episode. So
it gave millions of dollars worth of free advertising.
Oh, yeah.
So they tend to backfire, and it seems to be backfiring in this case as well, and hopefully that will continue. At this time, I could still link to their videos on YouTube, so we'll provide the link, and I noticed there that also they include a copy of the original waiving of the copyright from the CSE website. It shows that the people behind the CSE are not interested in intellectual debate. They're not beyond using intimidating tactics to silence their critics, even when they know that they're wrong. Because they're taking down from their websites the statements where they waived their copyright. Which is completely disingenuous. I mean, who do they think they're fooling? First of all, these things are all archived, so you can't pretend like it was never there. So they're really just, in fact, that's like an admission on their part,
right,
that they actually were giving away their copyright, because if that wasn't the case, then why would they bother to take them down? So, good luck to the extant dodos to weathering these tactics, and we certainly support your goal of bringing the critical eye of skepticism towards these nonsensical creationist claims that the CSE are making. Well, let's move on to a few questions and emails. The first email comes from Alan Prattis, who writes, "Are you guys or the hosts of the podcast affiliated with the Science Coalition? What are, if any, the corporate sponsors that you currently have?" So I just included this email for the record, since the question comes up, we might as well answer it on the show for everybody, that we have no corporate sponsors or corporate affiliations. We only have a couple of affiliations, and they are stated outright. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society, and it is in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation, because James Randi contributes his Randi Speaks to our show, and with skeptic.org, who gives us the lovely Rebecca.
Hello.
That is the beginning and ending
of
our affiliations.
One.
What?
Remember those Men in Black?
Oh, yeah. Bob, we can't talk about the Men in Black.
Oh, sorry. Just cut that.
Then the vast government conspiracy.
Imagine if we were government subsidized. Wow, would we have a lot of money at our disposal?
So, yeah, we are not some corporate shell. We're not, an ideological think tank. We're not, we're not denialists for any corporate interests, right? I think we're totally homegrown, independent. We're a nonprofit organization, and so far we've been surviving entirely upon donations and membership fees.
And let's not forget our inexhaustible elbow grease.
That's right.
Ew.
No, it's not inexhaustible. I should wear.
Yeah, speak for yourself, greasy elbows.
I'm Italian. I mean, I got, the stuff's coming out of me nonstop. I can't help it.
The next email comes from Jeff Zerf in Australia. That's S-Z-E-R. I hope that pronounced that correct. And Jeff writes, "I'm sure you'd be pleased that I often question what I hear, even on SGU, and I'm halfway through episode 111, and I had to respond to your, Steve's, aside about peanuts and other nut allergies. Peanuts are not nuts." He then goes on to explain that peanuts are legumes. And that is correct. Peanuts are, in fact, legumes. Well, Wikipedia says peanuts are also known as earth nuts, goobers, goober peas, pindas, jacknuts, pinders, manila nuts, and monkey balls. I had to throw that in.
No way.
Monkey balls.
Monkey balls.
That's what I'm going to call them from now on.
Doesn't everybody call them jacknuts?
In the UK, these are sold as monkey nuts.
I'm going to get me a handful of them salted monkey nuts.
Oh, my God.
And put them in your mouth. Balls. Right.
Absolutely.
Right. But they are, in fact, legumes. The next email is also a follow-up from last week. This one comes from listener Alan, who writes, "Just listened to the September 5th, 2007 podcast. Who is the African-American community concerning the King Tut controversy?" In quotes. Again, is this Jesse Jackson or Al Sharpton? By African-American community, was this from a poll with a reasonable sample and error margins of blacks? You mentioned that there are those who think, again, who are these people? You seem to state that some loony white people believe some idiotic belief and limit it to this. You should also point out the source concerning what is the African-American community and what this represents. Much too often I have seen racists posting items as if they were from the African-American community, which, in my opinion, as a black man, I've been to Africa and I am not African anything, to cause confusion and doubt. In addition, the media seems to have anointed people like Jesse Jackson or Al Sharpton as black leaders, and again, I do not recall the election when I voted these people as my leaders. So please state the source of your stories. African American community is a little vague, right? Sorry for the rant, but I am not from the inner city and I am black, period. And I think science is the way. Thanks, Alan. So actually, I emailed Alan back to letting him know the source of the story, which is on the notes page. It wasn't when he emailed me, because I was late in putting up the notes page for last week's episode, but it's up there now. And this was the story was from NPR and did give the source and quoted the individual people who were saying that. But, you know, Alan's point is well taken, and I didn't mean to give the impression that this belief was either representative of the black community or even common in the black community, and there wasn't any kind of survey about, you know, who believes this. It was just, you know, specific people who were making the claim. This was the specific claim that King Tut was being portrayed as too European or Caucasian in the display, and that they, to be historically accurate, King Tut should have been displayed with more like sub-Saharan African features. I read this email just to acknowledge Alan's point that, yes, this was not meant to say that this was in any way representative. I was just bringing it up just to discuss that specific opinion.
Wait, so I missed this news story because I was in Alaska. Can you just recap? Is King Tut not our favorite honky?
Well, yeah, as I said, I think the historical evidence shows that the Egyptians of that time were a genetically and morphologically a mixture between Mediterraneans and sub-Saharan Africans. So they were tan in color, which is how they were portrayed by artists at the time, and how they were portrayed in the museum. So the image that you have of King Tut is probably historically accurate.
Okay, Steve, that was a very good response to what was actually just a joke about a Steve Martin song.
You don't remember that song,
thank
Steve?
Thank you.
I do now.
Remember that?
I do now. I loved that song.
Rebecca's a little giggly tonight. She tells us she's sleep deprived.
I haven't slept in weeks.
The next email comes from none other than Michael Horn, who we have discussed previously on this podcast.
I loved him on Star Trek: The Next Generation. Oh, that was Michael Dorn. Sorry.
Oh my God.
Michael Horn is the authorized American media representative of the Billy Meyer contacts.
The what?
The Billy Meyer contacts. Billy Meyer is the Swiss farmer who claims that he has been in long-term contact with aliens and has documented this contact with pictures, etc.
Oh, of course.
But the evidence strongly suggests that the entire thing is an elaborate hoax.
Oh, come on, Steve.
But Michael is not of that opinion, and he writes to us, says, to Dr. Novella and organization, I suggest that I appear on your radio show to both answer the false charges below and have you defend them.
Radio? We're doing radio?
Pretty much.
Apparently.
Okay.
I have a rather vast readership, and I will be glad to announce the details of the interview to them. Failure to provide me with such an opportunity or to respond to this request will be construed as a withdrawal by you of and an apology for these widely circulated false claims and will be publicized as such. The following disinformation, defamatory, and libelous claims are attributed to you. And then he clips from the Encyclopedia of Skepticism and the Paranormal, three brief paragraphs that we wrote about 10 years ago summarizing the Billy Meyer UFO hoax. He's been whining about this to me for years, Michael Horn. We actually talked about whether or not we should interview Michael for the show. I mean, a la the interview we did with Neil Adams, and decided against it for a couple of reasons. One, I'm not going to be threatened and manipulated by people to come on our show. I mean, Michael does this all the time. This is his modus operandi. He sends letters to skeptics, to prominent skeptics, saying, do this, meet my ridiculous demands, or I will construe that as you admitting that you that the Billy Meier things are real, and et cetera. Then he sends out a press release. He's actually sent out a press release saying, skeptics admit that that UFOs are real and Billy Meier is, you know, whatever he wants to say. Uh-huh. But it's all an admission of just ignoring him. So if you ignore him, you're admitting all this stuff.
For that reason alone, I would vote that maybe we should interview him and see how it goes. But because of that one paragraph in this email, the fact that if we fail to respond, it will be construed as a withdrawal. That reason alone, I do not want to have this guy on our show. I mean, that is such a pathetic attempt.
If he fails to give us a pony, that means he's an idiot.
He's admitting that he's an idiot, and he's lied about everything his whole life.
Yes. Right. I look forward to my pony.
Right.
I'll be even more direct. Chuckles. Michael Horn, you're an ass. If Perry was still here,
he
Perry would say, you are a total ass.
This guy's really despicable. He harasses skeptics. I mean, he's done it to Michael Shermer. He's done it to CSI West. He's done it to Randy. This is what he does. He just goes around harassing skeptics, making these ridiculous kind of 1-2 claims where he says, if you don't do this, then I'm going to send out a press release saying all these bad stuff about you. The other reasons why I don't think it would be a good idea to have this guy on the show is because I've been in extensive email conversations with this guy, and he's not coherent enough, to interview. His debating tactics are so lowball that we could really even have a meaningful discussion with him on the show. It was tough enough in writing. At least in writing, I could, spend time to try to get him to make one specific claim. And then, it would take a long time to actually do the research to find out what the real story was behind the claim. That's not the kind of thing that we could do in real time. He could throw out so many claims that things that we hadn't heard before, we wouldn't be able to have time to do the research to find out what the story was. A real-time discussion or debate wouldn't be a good way to really get to the bottom of the claims that are being made on behalf of Billy Meier. I would much rather do that in writing, where we could focus on a topic. And if you recall, I gave the results of my previous, written discussion with Michael. He was the one who was defending Billy Meier's photographs of those 70s dancers from the television
yeah,
show.
Yeah, that was awesome.
He took a picture of a TV show.
And he was also defending the flying saucer dangling from a string, embarrassingly ridiculous video. He still is. I mean, this guy's never going to give that up.
And what was the comment, Steve, when we were talking before the show, that nobody's been able to duplicate some of these images and using any method, any Hollywood special effect or Photoshop or whatever.
And that's what they
say.
That's what proponents of Billy Meier say.
Yeah. Okay, but not necessarily this guy.
He says that. He absolutely says that. But of course, they don't accept our explanations, So here, the other thing is, we got to just today. So this is 4 days after Michael's, semi-threatening email. We get an email from Mike Scirocco from Santa Cruz, California, and he writes, why didn't you guys accept Horn's invitation to a debate? If you're willing to print negative comments about someone, don't they deserve the opportunity to debate you openly? I guess the fact that Meier published several observations decades before science could confirm them, or produces hundreds of UFO photos that nobody has been able to prove are faked or manipulated, doesn't buy him any credibility at all in your eyes. Kind of makes you look bad in my book.
This guy know that. That
I wonder
that
if the two of them know each other.
Invitation to a debate.
How did he find out? And why was his email time stamped hours in the future? That's what I want to know.
Because he's an alien from the future. Hello.
Yeah, obviously he's an insider lackey. Trying to up the heat on us or something. It's ridiculous.
Or it's Mike Horn himself.
Interesting.
Could be an alias.
It's possible.
But let's just pretend that Mike Scirocco is a real guy. Let me answer his first question in his email. Why didn't you guys accept Horn's invitation to a debate? Mike, because he's an ass.
And because it wasn't an invitation. It wasn't an invitation. He didn't ask nicely. He threatened us. And I agree with Bob. Even if we wanted to have him on principle alone, the answer is no.
I have a question. Why are these people seeking our approval in some way?
Yeah, they have a kind of pathological fascination with their critics. They really do.
If their evidence stands on their own, that should be good enough for them. They should not care what we as skeptics think.
Because, Evan, it's validation. It's validation. Yeah. It's like them. It's them, you know, building steam behind their cause. I mean, what else are they going to do? Are they going to wait for Billy Meyer to cook up some more fake UFO pictures? You know, like, what else do these guys have to do?
Yeah, he's trying to set up for so he could send out the press release or say to whoever his readers are that this is what happened. But also, and since they bring it up again, let me just make this perfectly clear to Michael, and I'll send him an email to this effect, too. He's not welcome on our show, and we are not recanting any of our prior statements about the Billy Meyer hoax, and we're not apologizing for anything. And if you say that we are, you're lying.
You know, and also, maybe we should clarify our stance on Billy Meyer himself. Okay, in our opinion, Billy Meyer is a complete and total liar, and he himself is an ass. He has made up every single picture that you see. It's completely fake. Mm. He faked every single one of them. You know, he's been accredited with over 1,000 UFO pictures. 1,000.
If what the evidence suggests is true, that these videos and photographs are fakes, then he had to be deliberately faking them. You know, it's not like he's misinterpreting ambiguous, you know, blobs of light or something. I mean, there's like models of UFOs attached to trees and hanging from strings. I mean, you know, that has to be a premeditated conscious fraud. There's no other explanation for that.
I mean, I'll admit, some of his pictures are pretty cool looking if you just, you know, could imagine, wow, if that was a real UFO, that would be really cool. But the fact that people look at them and really buy into it is a testament, like you said,
especially when they're swinging like a pendulum in the air. Yeah. It's called the pendulum star drive.
Right, that, Bob. Don't laugh. I mean, they say, well, how do you know that their drive mechanism doesn't create that same kind of movement?
Yeah, how do you know, Bob?
They do have it is a pendulum drive. That's what it is.
It's called a string drive.
String drive.
Let me guess, when they were, because I don't recall seeing it or the video or anything, but let me guess, when it's dangling, it's right inside the frame of the picture. It doesn't go out of frame at all. That's just a guess on
Look,
my part.
Look, Evan, obviously you don't understand string theory, so maybe you shouldn't even bring the topic.
It's only a theory. Hey, it's only a theory. It's never been proven.
Billy Meyer also does the whole World War III. Is going to happen. He said it's going to happen in November 2006,
God, another...
or 2008,
so he's a...
or 2010.
So he's a prognosticator.
Or 2011.
Did I miss that last year?
That's great.
He tries to make predictions, but they're laughable.
So Billy Meyer is this guy's Jesus.
It's basically a UFO cult. It is a UFO religion that Meyer's building up around him with revelation and, you know, and this the secret writings that, you know, he had to copy. He doesn't have the originals anymore. Everything.
It's fair enough. Billy Meyer's called skeptics groups cults, secular cults.
Secular cults.
To quote him. So I guess that's fair.
So let's go on to our interview. Joining us now is David Cahoon. David, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Hello. Good morning.
Professor Cahoon is a professor of pharmacology at the University College London, and he is the author of the Improbable Science blog, where he regularly attacks the nonsense that calls itself alternative medicine. I first came to the attention of your blog, or your blog first came to my attention over the issue of it being removed, actually, from the UCL servers. Can you tell me about that incident?
Yes, that was an interesting incident. I didn't know quite what the motive for it was. Well, the immediate motive was that a couple of herbalists whom I had pointed out were talking a load of rubbish, essentially. Mm-hmm. A woman called Anne Walker and her husband, Alan Lakin. They were using always their address, or she was using her address, at the University of Reading Nutrition Department. And, in fact, I discovered she was only working one-tenth time for them. And she also was working for the health, information service, mm-hmm. To do with nutritional supplements. I don't know whether she was paid for that or never. I never succeeded in discovering, but I do know she was writing editorials and not declaring. betraying that interest, and I thought that was all a little dodgy. And she ran the herbal treatment practice from her house, I think. So I pointed that out to them. Result was that they started writing letters, and they wrote letters not just, well, they never wrote to me at all, actually. They wrote to the head of the college, what you would call the president, we call him the provost at UCL.
Mm-hmm.
And she wrote to the chair of council of UCL, quite persistently so, long letters of a sort of rather threatening nature, threatening legal action, and it caused a great nuisance. The gist of it seemed to be that she'd used the term blood cleanser, and I said that this was gobbledygook.
Right.
And had no defined meaning. And this really, really upset them. I actually later got a well-known philologist, Michael Quinion, who writes a lovely column on the web called Worldwide Words, to go into the history of the term blood cleanser. And, of course, it's been used by quacks or mm-hmm. way back. And it's never had any defined meaning. And that's why I stuck with it being gobbledygook.
Right.
And this really, really upset them. So they caused an enormous amount of nuisance to the college, actually, and I'm not surprised. UCL got pretty fed up about it. But nevertheless, I was pretty surprised when the provost asked me to remove the site from the server where it had been always since I started it. And I was actually even more surprised that he said, it would look better if I said that I'd done it voluntarily rather than being told to. That isn't true. So
right.
It said what had actually happened, that I'd been told to remove it. It's quite clear that our provost had underestimated the power of the blogosphere, since I put up a notice saying that I'd been asked to remove it from the server, and within hours he was getting letters from the States, from Australia, all over the place, saying that this was the biggest public service that UCL did, and what did he think he was doing,
right?
And so on. I was quite amazed at the support I got from around the world, mostly from people I'd never heard of, and quite gratified, of course, by that. And he spent an entire weekend answering this bombardment of letters, and realized that there's some pretty uncomplimentary remarks appearing on the web, and he quite quickly gave in and said I could take it back to UCL. In fact, I haven't taken it back to UCL because I wanted to change it to a proper blog format where you could leave comments. That might have
right.
been coming. It might have left made some problems for UCL, so I did move it, and it stayed moved since then. But it was an interesting experience because it did show the real power of communications, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The power of the web. And the news spread very rapidly, and the support was marvelous from all over the place. I only published one of the letters, one from Stanford. Like I said, it just shows that you really can do things on the web.
Now, the incident brings up a lot of, I think, very important features. One is, as you say, the power of the blogosphere to raise an issue to public attention, so something that might otherwise fly below the radar. And, you know, I was one of the bloggers to jump to your defense because, to me, it represented, you know, there. I think there is a cultural battle going on between those who are dedicated to scientific legitimacy and those who are really, you know, tearing at the foundations of science, especially within the halls of healthcare. And the question is, what side are the universities going to be on? And if they're going to be on the side of science and reason, are they going to be, you know, stalwart? Are they going to actually stand up to the charlatans, or are they going to cave at the slightest, you know, saber rattling? So it seemed like a nice line in the sand, you know, to fight over, and it worked out.
Yes. Actually, I'm not so much interested, I think, in homeopaths. We'll never get rid of that entirely. I don't suppose that one hopes it'll subside a little when the sort of what I call the Bush Blair era fades. But I'm much more interested in the attitude of universities and politicians. These things go much higher than a few homeopaths on the high street. And there are 5 degrees in homeopathy in British British universities. They're all the so-called post-1992 universities. You may not realize this, the history in the States, but in 1992, John Major's government, the Conservative government, actually converted all the polytechnics and technical colleges into universities. Mm-hmm. And created overnight a large number of universities, which were often not universities in the traditional sense. They were teaching very applied subjects, and there's been a lot of writing about Mickey Mouse degrees in things like golf course management and outdoor adventure with philosophy and things like that. Mm-hmm. They're quite, of course, quite different from the traditional sort of things like maths and history and physics and pharmacology. So this was quite a big change, but I personally don't get too upset about degrees in golf course management or outdoor adventure. They're different from the traditional degrees, for sure, but they're quite honest. I do get very upset, though, about degrees in homeopathy or herbalism, because they're not true. You know, if you have a degree in golf course management, everyone can see what it is. You've presumably learned something about managing golf courses, and there's nothing untrue or...
nothing deceptive about it.
But degrees in homeopathy are. And the university will not make the distinction. It's been quite a battle raging over it quite recently. There's a committee in the UK, the Committee of University, well, it used to be called the Committee of Vice-Chancellors and Principals. It's the gathering of all the presidents, as you would call them, of all the universities in the country. And I just had a quite vociferous correspondence with them about this, because an outfit called the Taxpayers Alliance pointed out there were 400 non-courses, sort of Mickey Mouse courses in British universities. And the Universities UK, this group of presidents, leapt to their defence in quite vigorous terms. They refused entirely to make any distinction between the courses that were dishonest, like homeopathy and complementary medicine, and those that were honest but simply not very intellectual. And so this attitude among a bunch of very senior academics, who, in my view, certainly ought to know better, was to just defend all of these courses in a blanket way, whether honest or dishonest. And this really alarms me. You know, this is much worse than the fact that you have a few homeopaths on the high street, or that even that the mm-hmm. National Health Service spends a fairly modest amount of money on homeopathy. The vice-chancellors themselves presumably are not great fans of homeopathy, but they nevertheless defend it. And this seems to me utterly dishonest and much more worrying than the complementary medicine itself.
And why do you think that is? Is it political correctness? Is it greed, because they want to maintain the offering of these degrees and the money that provides? Or do they not really see how dishonest a medical degree in homeopathy is?
You know, I have absolutely no idea. I sort of explained it at great length to the present head of the University of the UK, who's also president of King's College London at the moment, Rick Traynor. All I get is a little note back saying, "Your views are noted."
Yeah.
In other words, it's a big shove-off.
Right.
Because your university's income depends on the number of students. The income comes from the government, and that part depends on the number of students
right.
you recruit. And so I suppose that the motive must be financial in the end.
Yeah.
But why they will not recognize the difference between these two different sorts of degrees, I just have no idea at all. It seems to me a great betrayal of what they're meant to do. And the university presidents behave rather like an old-fashioned trade union, where they defend anything that universities do, whether it's right or wrong. It's quite funny, really. It looks this body of august senior academics behaves like, Teamsters Union or something when it comes to defending their territory.
It's incredible. And it does. I do think it has fallen largely to the science bloggers to fill the gap.
Yeah, it's only the bloggers who are actually doing much about this. And then every now and then I get a piece into Nature about it, and that's fairly high profile and get some publicity. But it doesn't seem to influence these senior academics or the politicians. Of course, politicians, as I'm sure is the case in the States, are almost always have no science regulations were recently changed for the labeling of homeopathic products. And actually, until recently, they hadn't been allowed to put any indications on the bottle. But now they are, I have to say, traditionally used for, but to the man in the street, that reads like a recommendation. And this, I think, was done because of the pressure from the Department of Health. There were several senior politicians, including, of course, Tony and Sherry Blair, while they were here, who are quite sympathetic to medical magic. The politicians have been no help. In fact, they've been a hindrance in stopping this sort of nonsense.
Yeah, that's what I find here, too, that there's a few true believers who are very active and drive the agenda forward. And most people either just don't care, don't understand the issues, or out of political correctness, don't feel that they should be critical.
Well, that's right. I think, you know, if I ask my colleagues in pharmacology about this, of course, they all pretty much agree with what I say, but they're all much too busy to spend any time on it.
Yeah. They say, I get the same thing, and they say, yeah, thank goodness you're doing something about it, so now I don't have to worry about it.
That's about it, yes, because, you know, as you well know, science itself has become highly competitive, over-competitive, I think, in my view, for optimum results. And these people are trying like crazy to get publications and promotion and so on. They haven't got time to run blogs or write to politicians and so on.
Mm-hmm.
They're on the side of right, but they don't do much about it, which is a little upsetting for people like me. But they come out of the woodwork when there's a crisis, as they did over being turfed off the server.
Mm-hmm.
And that's great. I think it's probably actually worse in the state, isn't it? I mean, NCCAM, is that how you pronounce it? The NIH has given, almost $1 billion to complementary medicine for zero results.
That's right. Yeah, the National Center for Complementary Alternative Medicine was basically forced down the NIH's throat by the Senate. And again, because there's just a couple of true believers that were pushing it forward. And even at one point, there was a scientist protested this, and it led to a very fleeting reduction in the increase in the budget, you know. But over the years, the budget has steadily increased.
That is an amazing phenomenon. This sort of stuff hasn't made much headway in the older universities at all here. But in the really respectable places like University of Pennsylvania Medical School, they have complementary people as part of their physiology and biophysics departments, is a very eminent department. And I've spoken to some of the people. They say, oh, yes, it's upsetting, but they don't get as heated about it as I would have expected. This, what the NCCAM is dishing out millions of dollars. Of course, university administrators will love that.
Yeah, they're happy to take the money, sure.
They're happy to take the money, regardless of how dishonest the whole thing is. That's pretty worrying to me.
Another issue that was raised by this episode that you had, and I think this is something that's worse in the UK than in the United States, is the liability to being sued for purposes of being harassed, being silenced. So the threat of suit for libel or slander, at least in the United States, the threshold, I mean, it could still be used as an intimidating factor, but the burden of proof is on the person bringing the suit. I understand that in the UK, the burden's more on the defendant to prove that what they said was not libelous. Is that correct?
I think that is correct, yes. It's quite worrying. I've got another person after me right now.
Yeah.
Patrick Holford, a writer, is stuff about nutrition. Well, he calls himself a nutritional therapist. You can always tell when the word therapist is tagged on that they're pretty much charlatans, in my view, at least. Mm-hmm. This is going to be broadcast. I better be very careful what I say. but his chap is caused enormous controversy in this country. There's a wonderful Holford Watch website which goes through in great detail what he's about, and he sent me a threatening letter recently, and that's got the blogosphere stirred up again. I think often they're not very serious threats.
Yeah.
More black.
Did he threaten lawsuits?
Yes. Well, his words were, "I reserve the right to take appropriate action." You know, the sort of vague threats of the law.
Yeah, but it could have a very chilling effect, and I can only imagine trying to be an outspoken critic over there, where you don't have even the presumption of innocence, essentially, if someone chooses to accuse you of slander.
Yeah, so it is quite nervous making, especially since I'm not on the college server anymore, so I'm rather on my own. So the letter he sent me on September the 11th had ended up, "I nonetheless believe it appropriate that you withdraw the allegations you have made and apologize for making these unwarranted and defamatory allegations, mm-hmm. provided that we can agree the wording of an apology and removal of the false claims. I am prepared to leave it there. However, I fully reserve my right to take this matter further should my complaint not be resolved to my satisfaction." So I posted a lot of riposte and I haven't apologized at all. So this is
Yeah, we get similar letters occasionally, not so eloquent, but the same gist. Basically, you know, apologize or we'll take action.
Yeah.
So far we've been lucky, but again, I usually have as my defense, what I've done is thrown back in their face, "Well, this is your burden of proof, and you know, if you pursue this, it's harassment," and that's when I'll pursue that. You know, that you're harassing me if you don't acknowledge that this is baseless. It's not as easy on your side of the pond.
Yes. Well, the things he was getting cross about were allegations about his attitude to vitamin C and the treatment of AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
He has activities in Africa, which is, you know, seriously worrying if he's going around Africa treating people with vitamin. And his Optimum Nutrition Bible, he writes books, not papers, he doesn't do any research, really.
Mm-hmm.
The quotation is, "Yet for the last 100 years, medicine has focused on drugs designed to destroy the invader, antibiotics, antiviral agents, chemotherapy. By their very nature, these drugs are poison to the body. AZT, the first prescribable anti-HIV drug, is potentially harmful and proving less effective than vitamin C." And the reference is to a paper by Pauling, Linus Pauling,
yeah.
and two colleagues, which doesn't actually test better than vitamin C at all. Now, subsequently, he's admitted that he cited the wrong reference, but even the right one that does test AZT and vitamin C uses vitamin C in a concentration which is at least 10 times greater than you could possibly get in serum, even with a huge dose mm-hmm. given orally. So, you know, the claims are pretty baseless, and he sort of backed off on that more recently. But that's what his book says, and that's what I was quoting. So I think I'm on reasonably safe ground there.
Sounds like it. Have you been dealing much with the issue of the controversy over the MMR vaccine and autism and Andrew Wakefield and sort of the scare that he raised in the UK?
Oh, yes, that comes up all the time. And this is a really interesting example because it's nothing to do with complementary medicine at all. It's to do with bad science, but bad science that was done in universities,
mm-hmm.
actually done in the Royal Free Hospital, which is now part of UCL, though thank God it was not at the time the work was done. It's not actually any Wakefield who did bad science, no doubt, with the hope of hitting the headlines. But a less publicized aspect of that was the university had latched onto this and promoted it and actually had taken out patents on the single vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
They keep very quiet about that now, but it's all on the web, actually. You can read about it. They had initially promoted this, I think, and promoted it with the hope of making money out of it. When you look closely and saw that the science was so bad, of course, it all blew up. But by that time, it was out in the newspapers, and the newspapers, of course, love bad news. And it's a really wonderful example of bad science journalism. I mean, Ben Goldacre, who's, I'm sure you're familiar with, badscience.net, has a lot to publicize the low standard of science reporting. And, of course, if you can splash a headline saying doctors are killing your children or giving them autism or something, then that's the sort of thing that packs in the readers. A thing saying studies show that MMR is perfectly safe, have no headline value.
Right.
And that was a problem at the time and continues to be a problem. There was something quite recently in the Sunday papers which was, again, not saying but raising alarm in the reader. Really quite unnecessarily.
Yeah, it's amazing to me that they're still doing it. They're still using those headlines, even though it's been shown to be crap for so long.
They're still using pictures of Princess Diana to sell newspapers.
Yeah.
I mean, they know what sells papers, I guess. But I see signs of change, you know, just as we may have got somewhere with homeopathy on the health service. Take The Guardian, which is a liberal national newspaper in this country. They had a big lifestyle supplement at one stage. And they had a column called What's the Alternative by a woman called Emma Nicholson, which is usually pure alternative junk, quote unquote.
Yeah.
But then later they got Ben Goldacre to write a column initially in the supplement, but now promoted to the main paper. And a lot of the New Age stuff has vanished. They have got Science website now, which is really pretty good. And I think that particular newspaper, which makes an interesting example, has turned away from New Ageism as a way of selling papers. The pressure for this had to come from outside. You know, Ben Goldacre is a practicing physician, but somehow managed to do the journalism as well. But the effect of that has been to raise standards for journalism in general, I think, a little. I mean, it's a slow process. But mm-hmm. I see grounds for optimism there. This nonsense has been going on for 30 years now, really. There's been a whole generation for which truth and falsehood became just a matter of choice, and it was perfectly acceptable to believe mutually incompatible things at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that I had pretty much a culmination in the belief in imaginary weapons of mass destruction quite recently. See, I think this is much bigger than complementary medicine. It's the general trail of enlightenment values, which homeopathy is only really a very small part. I sense that people are getting a bit fed up with that era, so in the next generation, things could be a lot better.
Yeah, I agree.
Despite all the evidence to the contrary.
No, I think you're right. I think, first of all, it is a broader sort of cultural thing. It's not just alternative medicine. It is, I think, the conflict between enlightenment and reason, as you say, and sort of New Age spiritualism and anything goes. And I do think the pendulum is starting to swing the other way. There's a bit of a backlash against, you know, all the nonsense. And I think on the background of that, I think the respect for science is something that generally increases over time. So I think in the long run, you know, science works, and that's a huge advantage, and it's something that will continue to push it forward. And I also agree with you that the science bloggers are taking an emerging role in this conflict away from the mainstream media, which I think are largely missing the boat, and even to some degree away from, you know, traditional academia, which are keeping their head in the sand.
Yes, it is amazing that a relatively small number of people do seem to be having a little influence, perhaps even mm-hmm. a growing influence. And that's terrific. It's great fun. The British Medical Journal is running next week an article about scientists and doctors who blog, which is apparently going to be quite a big feature. Mm-hmm. They're realizing that we're taking some of the initiative from them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's good because it makes them more willing to publish stuff from us.
Right. Well, David, thank you so much for giving us your time. We appreciate it.
I enjoy that a lot.
Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
And now, Randy Speaks.
Randy, I have noticed that some mentalists, magicians whose act includes mind reading and other similar tricks, either pretend or let their audience believe that they have real psychic abilities, while others are more upfront about the fact that they're doing standard illusionist tricks. Can you share with us your thoughts on this matter?
Back in the 30s, there was a gentleman named Ted Annemann, who was very, very famous in mentalism circles and in magic circles, for that matter, who wrote a distributed magazine distributed by mail that was specifically for the magicians and for the mentalists. It was called The Jinx. Annemann did bullet catches very, very dramatically, shedding blood and all kinds of good things in order to make it convincing. And he did a lot of mentalism stunts, some of which Geller is using today in his stage show with moderate success, I guess. Annemann found himself in this peculiar position where he couldn't deny that he had mental powers, but he was still allowing people to believe he had mental powers. Joseph Dunninger, later on, had the same phenomenon occur to him. He would always wink at the magicians and smile and say, I never bribe anybody, which wasn't one of the methods that mentalists would use in any case. But he sort of left it at that. And he used all the standard methods that mentalists have always used, though some of them were very wisely and properly adapted to his particular format. I think that he gave generally the idea that he was in possession of psychic powers, though he never actually stated it. He never said it that way. It was just sort of a wink and a nod with him. He allowed people to believe what they wanted to believe, I guess. Now, that has limited value in this field, I think. But nonetheless, that's what Joe Dunninger chose, and he was a good buddy of mine, and certainly a magnificent performer. I don't think anyone has equaled him, with the possible exception of a gentleman in England now named Darren Brown. Now, Darren Brown has found himself, I think, in a bit of a quandary, because by saying that he uses psychological means and reading people's faces and reactions and such to accomplish some of his stunts, and they are all excellent, unqualifiedly excellent. I can't describe them any other way, because he builds a great scenario around each and every one of his demonstrations. And he's widely known in the UK, and he's going to be shown over here as well, so we can look forward to that. But Darren Brown is sort of on the horns of this dilemma, as many of them have found themselves, where he can't really support this business of that he uses psychological observations and body motions and expressions and such, when he absolutely does not. He uses standard techniques of the mentalist. Now, mentalists don't take chances. You can't very well go out on a limb on a major television program, especially if it's live, and absolutely flounder and fail just because you were depending upon reading some subtle cues. Now, a lot of subtle cues are read by the mentalist. They have to be aware of what people will do under given circumstances. They have to know what to expect. They have to know how to analyze reactions and movements and various bodily gimmicks that people use. So that is true to a certain extent. But at the bottom of it, it's got to be something where they will definitely know the results one way or the other and be absolutely certain of them, or they can't take a chance. Now, when you're doing personal readings, doing cold readings or something like that, yes, you can do that. You can certainly flounder around, because the victims are going to accept no matter how badly you fail. Sylvia Brown is a master of this. Even on live television, she'll fail utterly. And then, of course, Montel Williams or somebody else will make some sort of excuse for her and try to solve the problem that way, and usually it's effective because the people are believers anyway, and they just dote on Sylvia's declarations. So it's a different matter with the professionals. It's a different matter with magicians who do a little bit of mentalism. They never want to take themselves too seriously, but the people who do mentalism as such, Banachek, for example, the leading exponent of this art internationally, I must say, and Banachek never makes any bones about it at all. He says that he's doing tricks, that this is something that anybody could do if they would just spend the time to learn to do it. He doesn't say that it's paranormal. He doesn't even hint that it might be paranormal, and he denies any such accusation. So he's certainly one of the good guys, and largely as a result, I think, of my influence on him, and I don't think that I had to prod him at all. He's basically an honest guy. So we have a wide range of problems here and a wide range of performers, some of whom allow people to think that they might have psychic powers, others that definitely try to get people to believe that they are psychic, and others who, like Banachek, absolutely disavow any ability in that direction. Though his performance is stunning. If you've seen it, I needn't tell you anymore. If you haven't seen it, go and take a look.
So would you say, to summarize, that in the age of TV psychics, mentalists have more of an ethical or moral responsibility to be upfront about their abilities?
I think they do, but I don't know that they actually do. The Society of American Magicians, who used to have an occult investigations committee, under Harry Houdini. The Society of American Magicians has discontinued that occult committee some time ago, and I've never been able to find out from them why, because they could be a good voice for reason in this sort of thing, but there are members there who come down on me heavily because they think I'm fighting the mentalism business. I am not. I'm fighting deception and lying and cheating. And I don't think that any of us should be involved in that sort of thing. No, we don't cut the girl in two pieces with a buzzsaw. No, we don't predict the outcome of a World Series accurately in a sealed envelope in a safe on top of the Empire State Building or whatever. No, we don't do those things. We appear to, and that's what the art of illusion is all about.
Randy, thank you.
My pleasure.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts. Two are real and one is fake. And then I challenge my skeptics, my Uber rogues, to tell me which one is the fake.
Uber rogues.
Are you guys ready for this week?
Yes.
Yep. Ready.
Jawohl.
Okay. Item number one. Chimpanzees in the wild have been observed hoarding and trading scarce succulent leaves as currency, exchanging them for food, preferred sleeping locations, and even sex. Item number two, cancer researchers find in animal studies that vitamin C does have cancer-fighting activity. And item number three, consumer researchers found that sales can be increased by first confusing consumers about their prospective purchase. Jay, go first.
Okay. The chimpanzees using leaves as currency seems a little thin to me just because, like, how long would those leaves last? Like, I just can't picture them going out, picking these leaves, hoarding them, and then kind of swapping them as currency. That seems a little too far of a stretch to me. The cancer researchers, one that, you know, vitamin C does have a cancer-fighting activity. I wouldn't be surprised to hear about, you know, a vitamin having that ability. I don't remember ever reading anything about that, though. And the consumer research, you know, the whole thing about them having, you know, sales will increase if they confuse. I'm always confused when I'm trying to buy something, so I think that is kind of built into it. So I'm going to go with the chimpanzee.
You're always confused.
Yeah, I think in general I'm just a confused person, but especially when I'm shopping for a deal.
Right.
I'll go with the chimpanzees as being the fake, Steve.
Okay. Evan?
I can't see how chimpanzees in the wild hoarding, trading scarce succulent leaves. It's elaborate. It's extensive. It seems a real stretch. But could be the curveball. There's always a curveball. However, in this case, I don't think so. So I'm going to agree with Jay. Chimpanzees, fake.
Bob?
I don't agree. The give and take, I can kind of see. You know, comparing it to money, that might just be a red herring. I don't know if you could really compare it to money, but the give and take, especially for sex, I can kind of see that. Although, I still don't like it. I don't like any of these anyway. But so I'm going to say one is okay. I'll say that's science. Vitamin C fighting cancer. I might think that one's okay too. But confusing consumers, and that's possible too. You use the bait and switch, or you kind of misrepresent. I mean, God, misrepresenting your product, I mean, that's pretty standard too. Read the first one again.
Sweet.
Oh, my God. Just pick one. It's monkey hookers, okay? Monkey hookers is the first one.
Monkey pimps. Monkey mafia. It's a whole underground city. World
you
of
got
chimp.
Monkeys smuggling it in. I mean,
I'm going to say vitamin C fighting cancer is fiction.
Okay, Rebecca?
Monkey prostitutes definitely exist. They have to because it's awesome. Increasing sales by confusing consumers, that seems almost like it'd be a trick question because it seems so obvious, but I'm going to say that that's true as well. So I'm going to say vitamin C does not have cancer-fighting activity.
Okay, so you all agree that consumer researchers found that sales can be increased by first confusing consumers about their prospective purchase.
For the moment, I do.
You all agree that that is science, and that is science.
Yay.
Yay.
So you all got that one correct. This is an interesting study, actually, and it's not just misrepresenting the product. What they did was they had several situations, either selling an item in a supermarket setting or trying to get students to join a student interest group or getting students to agree to an increase in tuition. And then they first presented it in a deliberately confusing fashion, and then they clarified the confusion. So, for example, they would say, you know, would you like to buy this item? It costs 300 cents. And then that, which was designed to create some confusion about, like, what does that mean? What does it cost? And then they clarified
that confuses
it.
Me.
Then they clarified
that mean?
By saying, it, you know, would you pay $3 for this? And that dramatically and statistically significantly increased the sales or the signing up for the interest group or whatever that they were studying. The thinking is that they're engaging the desire for cognitive closure. So you create confusion, and then you offer them a simple clarifying option, and they'll choose it just to get cognitive closure on what was initially a confusing situation. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I should try it sometime. I mean, yeah, it makes
sense.
I'm
confused.
That reminded me of the claims for neuro-linguistic programming, where they claim that they use what's called an interrupt, which is similar to what they're calling in this experiment, which is a disrupt, where an interrupt is something where you like if you go to shake somebody's hand, then rather than shaking it, you do something else unexpected and unusual. And that puts somebody in sort of a confused and sort of searching mode. And then you offer them some clarifying option, which they then take, like, give me your wallet, you know, and they do it. This is like Darren Brown's shtick. It was reminiscent to me of that, of sort of creating a confused state of mind and then following that up with the something that will sort of offer the person clarity or resolve this confusion, but in a direction that you want. You guys are split on the first two. Bob and Rebecca, you think that the vitamin C cures cancer or it has cancer-fighting activity is fiction, and Jay and Evan, you think that the chimpanzees using currency is fiction. Let's start with number two. Cancer researchers find in animal studies that vitamin C does have cancer-fighting activity, and that one is science.
Yes.
No, Bob, that means you got it wrong.
Oh. Wait, didn't I say it was science?
Nope, you said that one was fiction. You said that one was fiction.
No, you misinterpreted me. You got to listen.
this study actually is one of those
it
was deceptively unusual and complicated, you know, stories where, like, if you knew more about the backstory, you would realize how different this news is. So here's the backstory. For a long time, the thinking was that the antioxidant effects of vitamin C may have cancer prevention or cancer fighting activity because antioxidants cause cell damage, and that may contribute to DNA damage caused by cancer, or that leads to cancer. But that never panned out. That research never panned out. If you may recall that Linus Pauling was a huge advocate of vitamin C, and this was one of his lines of justification. It prevents antioxidants from causing DNA damage, which cause cancer. So vitamin C should prevent cancer. It turns out that research never panned out, and that vitamin C probably does not have any benefits to cancer, or because of the cell damaging effects of free radicals, of the oxidants. What this study found is that vitamin C, by inhibiting free radicals through its antioxidant effect, may in fact help cancer, but through a completely different mechanism, an unexpected mechanism. That there is a protein that is called hypoxia-induced factor, or HIF-1. HIF-1 allows cells to survive in a low oxygen or a hypoxic setting, and that protein is dependent upon free radicals for functioning. So the vitamin C may be reducing the free radicals, therefore reducing HIF-1. Therefore, cells will not be able to survive as well in a hypoxic situation. Now, cancer cells, because they're always, you know, outgrowing their blood supply, many cancer cells do have to be adapted to a hypoxic or an oxygen-starved situation. So, you know, it's always interesting when things work, but not by the mechanism that it was originally supposed that they would work through. It also occurs to me that this could be a bad thing and could explain why there's been some evidence that that high doses of antioxidants may increase risk for things like heart disease. Because you know this, the HIF-1 occurs naturally in the body for a reason. It's not there to be used by cancer cells. It's there to be used by regular tissues. So perhaps chronic high doses of antioxidants may in fact inhibit all of our tissues' abilities to survive through relative low oxygen periods of time. So maybe if you have impaired cardiac blood flow and your heart is muscles are trying to survive with borderline oxygenation, high doses of antioxidants may be counterproductive. And it just goes to show you the big picture is biological systems are very complicated, and this is why you can't extrapolate from preclinical data. You have to look at the net clinical effect of stuff because there's always really complicated secondary effects that you could never account for up front. All of this means that chimpanzees in the wild have been observed hoarding and trading scarce succulent leaves as currency, exchanging them for food, preferred sleeping locations, and even sex is fiction. Now,
I can't believe you would taunt us with the idea of monkey hookers.
Yeah, I know. The monkey pimps and hookers and everything is very taunting. Now, the piece of this that is new and that makes this fiction is the chimps using currency in the wild is not true.
And very alluring.
It's always hard to prove a negative. I did what I do in these situations when I make up something fake, because I search on it as much as I can, and I could not find any report of that behavior being observed. But I found lots of pieces of this being observed. In fact, you can teach chimpanzees and monkeys, and chimpanzees are apes, not monkeys. You could teach some species of monkeys. In fact, there's a Yale monkey lab that's doing a lot of this research. You can teach them to use currency. If you give them like poker chips, and then they could either trade certain colored poker chips for specific food items, they learn the value of the chips, and they know what they're going to get in exchange for them, and they'll hoard the chips for the stuff they like and trade them for the food that they like, and they'll ignore the ones that they learn over time doesn't trade for something that they like. And then they could also be taught to do tasks to earn the chips, and then they'll hoard the chips, The other pieces that have been observed, this was inspired by a recent study in which male chimpanzees were observed stealing very highly desirable foods, usually like fruits from human habitations or human farms, and then using that food as a gift to females as part of the mating process. So they're impressing the female chimpanzees with their daring deeds and acquiring this the very desirable food. Among bonobos are entirely oversexed chimpanzees,
and also much less violent than
yeah.
chimps. When they have a difficulty, they have an orgy, and everyone feels better.
Yeah, that's not fighting. It's just all have a big orgy.
Is that an excuse for all your anger, Bob? Are you pent up? Like, what's going on, buddy?
Yeah, whatever.
Bonobos have been observed trading food for sex. So there are still chimpanzee prostitutes, Rebecca, if that makes you feel any better.
I guess that's okay then. So long as there's hot bonobo on bonobo action, I'm fine.
All right, I knew I should not have had a science or fiction that had the word sex in it.
And monkey, come on, Steve.
Or monkey.
Monkey. Chimpanzee, let's be accurate.
Chimpanzee.
Evan, save me. Go on to, can you read us last week's puzzle?
Sure. Here we go. Once upon a time, there was a king, and he enjoyed reading books. His sole urge was to better express his personality through his readings. The impersonal life he led would cause him to travel far and wide. It was once said that he would always travel with his three favorite books. The first book was a Bible, and the second book was a guidebook. Can you tell me the title of the third book? And we did have a correct answer.
I think I know who it is, but I don't know what
Harry
the third
Potter.
Book is.
Yeah. Few people guess that, I think.
Is it the king?
The king, as in, yes.
Elvis? Sir.
Elvis. Aaron Presley himself. And
I like the soul urge.
Soul urge is a numerological term having to do with numerology. The answer was Shiro's Book of Numbers, which is a old numerology book from 1920 is when it was originally printed.
that book apparently heavily influenced his spirituality on many different levels. So you had to put all that together to come up with his numerology book. And the winner is, in fact, goes by the name of Peacock on the message boards. So congratulations to Peacock for being the first one, and I think the only one, to answer it correctly.
Evan, what's this week's puzzle?
All right, we have a logic puzzle this week.
Okay, logic puzzle, check.
Here, this week's puzzle is a logic puzzle. So put on your logic caps, all right?
Okay.
So each of these sets of numbers represents an object. And here they are. 4, 4, 6, 8, 6, 12, 6, 8, 12, 20, 12, 30, 12, 20, 30. Identify each object by name. So absorb that for a while, give it your best shot, and good luck, everyone.
Jay, do you have a quote for us?
I have a quote from Carl Sagan, Dr. Carl Sagan. And he said, I maintain there is much more wonder in science than in pseudoscience. And in addition, to whatever measure this term has any meaning, science has the additional virtue, and it is not an inconsiderable one, of being true. Carl Sagan.
Always happy to quote Carl Sagan.
Didn't he also say science delivers the goods?
That was a somewhat more pithy statement, but yes, he did. Yeah, delivers the goods as in it's true. It actually has a relationship to reality. Well, thank you for another good show, everyone.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Good times.
Always a pleasure. And Rebecca, welcome back again. Glad to have you back
with
us.
Very good to be here.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. Please send us your questions, suggestions, and other feedback. You can use the Contact Us page on our website, or you can send us an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission. Endless delays.